Welcome to the Sunstone Podcast, everyone. I'm Stephen Carter, your host for this week, and it's been an interesting one. I received Patrick Mason's book, Restoration, God's Call to the 21st Century, from the Faith Matters Foundation a little while ago, and I finally got the chance to read through it. The fact that it's only 100 pages definitely helped, but I wanted to get to this book because, well, I like Patrick. He wrote a really nice blurb for a book I published a few years ago, and he's participated in Sunstone events in the past. And of course, he's the guy who wrote Planted, which was the first time Deseret Book had ever acknowledged the possibility that a faith crisis could be a spiritually formative process instead of mere apostasy. So, I wanted to see what he had to say now. One of the main ideas he presents is that the church is moving into its third century, and that the church has changed since its founding. It started as a fortress, he said. We were retreating further and further into the West, and then once we got to Utah, we built up our own kingdom. And then, when Utah became part of the United States, the church continued to keep the distinction between us and the rest of the world. We were, you know, in a defensive stance. But being a fortress no longer works in today's culture. That is, if we want the church to survive and continue growing. And I would say that Mason is definitely right. However, his point implies something really interesting. The church started as a revolution, you know, a whole new way of interpreting and interacting with the world, and so it attracted revolutionaries, people who wanted to do something new and exciting, something that gave their lives meaning in a much larger sense than they were used to. But now, 200 years in, the church is well established. It has plenty of resources. It has plenty of power. Revolutions are no longer interesting to the church. It learned how to gather power according to the rules and would now prefer that those rules remain stable. Most of the church members that I interact with also prefer stability. They like the way that the church gives their lives direction and meaning. They aren't looking for anything else. They're not revolutionaries. And this is a funny position for the church to be in, because what it means is that we've reached the point that a lot of Protestant churches had reached in Europe when Mormonism was first starting. You know, they had plenty of power and resources. In some cases, they had become, you know, state churches. They weren't looking for revolution. They wanted things to remain stable so that they could maintain their power and influence. And that was one of the reasons why they disliked Mormonism so much. It was a revolution. It wanted to destabilize things. So, zipping back to today. Even though the LDS Church makes much about how revolutionary its roots are, revolution is no longer on the table. In fact, revolution is not even welcome as an idea. If you start a revolution, you're no longer part of the church. The main parts of the restoration have happened. Nothing else big is going to occur. We've reached the point where we make tiny course corrections, you know, adding and subtracting little things like logos, program names, and when we go to church. And Mason accepts this. The main parts of the restoration have occurred. The church has taken on its essential form. The LDS Church is here to stay. From now on, we're working from a tradition rather than trying to start a new one. So if we want to work with the church, we need to work with these bones, this architecture. However, Mason also points out that plenty of general authorities, including the current president of the church, have said that the restoration is ongoing, that more is going to happen. And Mason takes that seriously. There is more essential work to do, not just, you know, maintenance work like we've been doing for the past 40 years. But what that means is that restoration isn't a very useful word anymore. It doesn't describe what we're trying to do. So, Mason proposes a new word. Renovation. Not a really inspiring word. Join the renovation! So, we're not the ones raising the building from the earth. We're the ones who are repainting the walls, adding an anteroom, making the building ADA compliant. Besides, renovation may make a building a bit more livable, but it also often strips it of its character. You know, for example, the Logan Temple, when it was converted to a film endowment temple, and the murals disappeared and we were left with these white walls. But Mason wants us to think of this renovation, as he says, quote, like a cross between a Habitat for Humanity project and an extreme home makeover, unquote. Well, I'll admit, that makes it a little more interesting. Maybe we could add murals. This could be an act of creativity and imagination. Could we possibly move away from the mauve that has reigned over the church buildings for the past 20 years? But to start the renovation, Mason doesn't mind tearing a few things down first. The first thing we need to do, he says, is get rid of some cultural baggage the church has picked up over the past 200 years. And the list he comes up with goes something like this. Oh, that old racist carpeting is really nasty. And the patriarchal linoleum is wearing pretty thin. And that cultural colonialism around your house, it's looking pretty fake. And that nationalistic decor could kill a charging rhinoceros. Can I just tell you, though, how much I love how you have all the light switches for the house collected in the master bedroom so that just one person has all the power? That kind of inequity must be really convenient for everyone! Did I mention the fundamentalist furniture? One size definitely does not fit all. So, a major section of Mason's book is this list of the cultural baggage he feels the church needs to get rid of before it can move forward. Namely, racism, patriarchy, nationalism, cultural colonialism, wealth inequity, and fundamentalism, not meaning polygamy. Now, at Sunstone, I've published a lot of articles that support getting rid of the things on that list. However, I think it's really essential to note why these things have been a part of the church. Essentially, it's because each of them are a social technology. In other words, they're patterns of interaction and behavior that help cultures gather power. For example, patriarchy is a social technology that defines roles and therefore focuses individual output. So men are assigned certain roles, usually leadership roles, and women are assigned certain roles, usually auxiliary roles. This means that children train to fulfill these roles so that when they are adults, they can function skillfully in those roles. Without all that training and years of practice, they would function less skillfully in the culture, and the culture would gather less power. You can definitely see patriarchy's power gathering functioning in Mormonism. Men and boys prepare themselves to be leaders, to enter the workforce, and to wield power, while women prepare themselves to raise a family and perform auxiliary functions. Of course, the patriarchy technology definitely has its downsides. I can hear my female listeners laughing at me right now for that understatement. The leadership potential of women is rarely utilized, and the nurturing potential of men is rarely even recognized, let alone valued. However, in a culture that is using patriarchy to gather power, it usually has enough leadership potential amongst its males and enough nurturing potential amongst its females to make the technology function the way the culture needs it to. So you can see that these social technologies do something. Small or even large groups can use them to gather power. Now, whether the human costs of gathering that power are worth it is a question well worth asking. But for now, we're just looking at what these technologies do. So we can see the same things happening in the other pieces of baggage that Mason and, incidentally, I want us to get rid of. Racism, for example, functions very similarly to patriarchy. It assigns roles and expectations to people based on skin color, and then trains them to fulfill those expectations. It provides a culture with inexpensive energy to build itself with. And it also has the same drawbacks of patriarchy. It makes no use of the many potentials of people with various skin colors. So please note that in saying all of this, I'm not supporting these technologies. What I'm doing is pointing out why they arise in a culture and how they function. These technologies do something. Otherwise, the cultures wouldn't use them. Wealth inequity, it functions similarly. When wealth is concentrated in a few people's hands, then big projects can get done because one person, or a few, are in charge of how resources will be used. Now, they may not always plan useful projects, but they can plan big ones. And wealth equity inequity is also where a lot of our art comes from. You know, some people have surplus money and they use it to support artists or to help create art. And people can only train to be artists if they have the time and the resources to do so. And a lot of our early scientific advances came from wealth inequity, because some of the rich people were interested in science, and they had the leisure and the resources to pursue it. So, in a society where wealth is distributed more equally, people focus their resources on various projects, which means that no huge projects get done unless a lot of political work goes into getting everybody on the same page. And then you're working on the politics rather than on the projects. So you're probably getting the hang of this now. Cultural colonialism is a way for social technology to work in other geographies and cultures. It provides a common symbolic and behavioral language for everyone to work with. Because, you know, getting something large done with many different languages and many different worldviews at play is difficult. So the social technology replicates itself in areas and among people that it's not native to, thus gathering power. And fundamentalism is just a more precise tuning of all those technologies. It's when you go in and codify smaller and smaller details so that the culture can perform more and more precisely. It certainly isn't good for individual expression, but it is good at getting everyone on the same page and working with the same symbol set and behavior patterns. And nationalism does much the same thing, giving a group of people a specific identity that they can all rally behind, giving them the impetus to work together. Of course, the other side of nationalism is that it keeps other ideas and other people from entering and possibly enhancing the culture. So, I've outlined all of this to show you the power dynamics behind what Mason is proposing. Even though, and probably especially because, I agree with him that we should get rid of all those technologies. It's true that they function as tools for gathering power. And it's also true that gathering power is essential for a culture to survive and grow, especially when that culture is in contact with other cultures that are also growing. Because, you know, when you're a small, struggling group, the more skillfully you can use social technologies, the more power your group gathers. Take, for example, the Oneida community. It started up around the same time Mormonism did, but it's no longer around because they didn't use many of the normal social technologies at the time. they had these more fluid gender roles. They had more fluid marriage structures and social expectations. It was all very experimental. But the social technologies they used didn't gather the power the group needed in order to survive and grow. And so the group eventually dissolved. And this is usually what happens when a group either diminishes or disappears. They may use some of the social technologies, but they either overuse them so that the community becomes too rigid to grow and it loses its ability to interact with the rest of the world, or it underutilizes the social technologies and therefore doesn't gather enough power to survive. But let's definitely note that the social technologies we've been talking about are not the only social technologies. They're just the ones that get used a lot. They're the main ones we've used to build up Western civilization. There are certainly other social technologies that could be developed and used. And hopefully, these new social technologies would have a much lower human cost and a much higher productivity. So, I agree with Mason. Getting rid of the social technologies of racism, patriarchy, nationalism, cultural colonialism, wealth inequity, and fundamentalism is a great goal. But how do we go about doing it? Our culture's power is built on these things. If we take away these technologies without replacing them with something else, then we lose the power and the coherence that they give us. If they just disappeared, we'd suddenly be in a power vacuum. And what usually happens in a power vacuum? The strongest and most ruthless people gather that power right up, which isn't exactly the goal. So, social technologies are a stay against chaos and a path toward growth. And we want both of these things. But the cost of using these old technologies that Mason is talking about is too high. We need to find something better. But what are those social technologies? Usually when we start talking about getting rid of these various pieces of cultural baggage, we get up on our high horse and we say, "We should do it because it's the right thing to do. We should do it because God tells us we should through the scriptures. Aren't all supposed to be alike unto God?" But if history has taught us one sad truth, it's that people rarely make changes because it's the right thing to do. I mean, if that were the case, we would have gotten rid of all these pieces of cultural baggage long before now. Humans make changes because it benefits them in a concrete and usually measurable way. That's just the way we work. And in order to make any progress toward dumping these old social technologies, we have to work with the way humans are. As Mason points out, secularism, rather than being the scourge that religious people often portray it as, has actually been a huge help in moving us toward dumping these old social technologies. It's absolutely true that religion used all of the old power-gathering technologies that we've been talking about. They used their theology to buttress rather than to question those technologies. So secularism was able to offer another culture that didn't rely so heavily on the old technologies, and it made room for other, sometimes more effective, social technologies to arise. Mormonism itself rose out of a context created by secularism. If the United States had had a state church in Joseph Smith's day, Mormonism would have had a way harder time developing. Secularism has also made us much more interested in the concrete, you know, in the measurable. If the main figure of a religion is, you know, the holy person wrapped up in a vision that only they can see, then the main figure of secularism is the scientist, wrapped up in a vision that needs to be replicated by others if it's going to be taken seriously. And since secularism is such a dominant force today, it's even a significant part of the worldview of religious people. But since it is, people want data. In this case, they would want to see how their lives would be concretely improved by dumping these old social technologies. And from a secular viewpoint, they're absolutely right to insist. The funny thing is, secularism actually deprived us of one of the social technologies that could have helped us get rid of these old social technologies. Namely, it got rid of the idea of a God who rewards or punishes humanity according to their righteousness or wickedness. See, when you have a God that rewards and punishes as part of a culture's technology, then people, you know, do get something measurable out of particular actions. Namely, the idea that they are saved, or, you know, that they're going to heaven, or that they're not going to hell when they do this particular action. In other words, they receive invisible goods, or goods that will be bestowed in the next life. This is an effective technology. We've seen it at work for millennia. However, for the most part, we don't have that technology anymore. The people who are interested in getting rid of these older social technologies either don't believe in a God who rewards or punishes, or that God is too bound up with these older technologies and supports them rather than questions them. So this brings us up against our challenge: to convince people that they are better off dumping these old social technologies that have such a high human cost. We need to show them how they will benefit, and they need to believe that it will be worth the work and the change, because it will be a lot of both. It's easy to say, well, let's just skip all that persuasion and start a revolution. But as Patrick seems to be arguing, that isn't a very useful answer. If a revolution is successful, then essentially what it does is that it hits the cultural reset button. But after that button is hit, then the revolution needs to start gathering power if it wants to stick around. And how does a culture stick around? By using social technologies that gather power. If we want to start a revolution with the explicit purpose of ridding ourselves of these old pieces of social technology, we would have to find new social technologies to gather power with. Technologies that, you know, don't have the same high human cost. Do we know what those social technologies are? I think that Mormonism reaches toward those technologies with its idea of Zion, but we haven't really done much to define what they might actually be. Instead, we just adopted those old social technologies. So this is what I think Mason is getting at when he said that we should participate in the restoration by participating in the renovation. Hitting the reset button by starting a revolution will just put us back at square one. We'll be back in the place where we have to start gathering power in order to survive. And that puts us in a difficult situation if we don't want to just use the old social technologies all over again. So the best idea is to work with what we already have. Instead of imagining our job to be restoring something that is perfect, we think about renovating the thing we already have. Now, as I pointed out earlier, it's certainly not as exciting. It makes us sound like the Protestants of Joseph Smith's day. I've heard us characterize them as merely a reformation, while we, on the other hand, were the restoration. And now, 200 years later, we're just a renovation? I mean, let's look back at early Mormonism. People joined the church not because it was the right thing to do. They didn't do it out of altruism or sacrifice. they joined the church because it gave them a new and compelling way to understand and value their lives. They were participating in the biggest religious event that had happened since the coming of Jesus. And for those who lived in the lower classes, Mormonism gave them the chance to come to Utah to get their own land and start building wealth. So it's easy to understand what drove them. But the question is, can the renovation inspire equal excitement and devotion? If it does, it will be because it does the same things that early Mormonism did. Provide a new and compelling vision of the meaning of one's life and offer a life that is concretely, measurably better than what people have now. So, Mason doesn't just stop at telling us which social technologies we should dump. He goes on to list what he thinks are the most important parts of the renovation, namely, re-enchantment, human identity, religious freedom, refugees and immigrants, social justice, and community. Quite an interesting list, and definitely a list that we'd need to really think through, since some of those words have some pretty heavy political baggage. How in the world could we get a largely conservative group like the Latter-day Saints to get behind the idea of social justice, for example? Are any of his suggestions actually viable as social technologies? Or would they just slowly leech away the power that the church has gathered with these old technologies? Let's go through Mason's suggestions and see what they have to offer. We'll start with re-enchantment. That's a pretty tough word to swallow in a secular age. It's even a hard word to swallow in a religious age, because to the secular mind, enchantment sounds like you're going into a fantasy world that ignores reality. And then to a religious mind, it sounds like you're being lured under the sway of a non-heavenly power. You know, you don't get enchanted by angels, you get enchanted by witches. And how in the world could re-enchantment be an effective social technology? Mason describes enchantment as a situation, quote, in which an expertly trained physician administers cutting-edge medicine, then, upon request, lays hands upon a person's head and invokes the powers of heaven to heal them, unquote. Now, initially, this sounds like, you know, someone leaving behind all the data and all the knowledge they've gathered over the years and leaping into some magical thinking, just in case. But let's expand it a little. Enchantment could be the process of opening a piece of yourself, a piece of your knowledge base, a piece of your value base to other models, and living in them temporarily. You know, seeing the world through that particular filter. But what good does that do? Well, it can introduce you to other tools for constructing the possibilities of reality. So, on the one hand, you have belief, which is more or less, you know, a permanent worldview, the one that you work with on a day-to-day basis. And every belief or worldview constructs reality a little differently. So they could be considered a kind of tool. And tools are particularly good at particular function. You know, a hammer is great for driving nails. A wrench, not so much, so you could make it do in a pinch. But if you need to tighten a nut, the wrench is your best option. And some tools are so specialized that they're totally useless except in the context that they were custom made for. So, enchantment is a way of temporarily immersing yourself in a particular worldview, one that's alien to your own. You know, maybe it's teeming with angels or ghosts or fairies, and then seeing what kind of connections it might have to your own worldview. or what new connections it makes you aware of, or what new specialized contexts you may not have been aware before. In other words, we could see enchantment as sort of a tool test-driving technology. In fact, a lot of scientific discoveries started with an image or a tale from mythology. You know, there's that example of the story of Auguste Kekulé. He was an organic chemist who theorized the structure of benzenine. And as the story goes, he fell into a doze while he was contemplating the problem, and he saw a vision of the Ouroboros, which is a mythological symbol of a snake biting its own tail. And it's a symbol that comes from a lot of mythologies, you know, from Egyptian to Grecian to Gnostic to Hermetic. So you could say that he fell under an enchantment. And then, using this mythological image, one that came from traditions that he didn't necessarily believe in, he added knowledge to his own worldview. So mythology, or, you know, religion, wasn't something he needed to escape in order to create knowledge. Rather, they were foundations that he could build from. A unique model of reality that suddenly connected with his own. Of course, knowledge advancement is only one of the uses of enchantment. It can also enhance, you know, emotional, psychological, and spiritual richness as well. And in fact, those are the uses that Mason is particularly interested in. So, let's use some enchantment to delve into his second suggestion for renovation, the expansion of human identity. Because Mason thinks it's great that LDS children sing, "I am a child of God." He feels like it imbues them with grand visions of their potential. If the rest of the world had such an expansive view of themselves, you know, how might humanity improve? But, of course, Mormons do have plenty of restrictions on how expansive our own view can be. LDS leadership has only allowed official church discourse to focus on a male God, even though our theology implies at least one female God. So for a long time, centuries, we've talked about a heavenly father to the exclusion of a heavenly mother. So, if we're to take Mason's advice and re-enchant the idea of God, perhaps our first exercise would be to imagine what our life might look like. Or, you know, what LDS theology might look like. What church would look like if we also had a female God that was front and center. It's a great place to start because this is a place where we have very little official direction. It's a fertile place to practice enchantment, with everyone exploring how the possibilities would look for themselves. So instead of the doctrine of a heavenly mother, you know, coming down from the hierarchy, which, admit it, is made up mostly of men, it could instead rise up from the individual members. A collection of dreams and visions that create a rich context for Mormon females to imagine their full potential, and for Mormon males to imagine an expanded heavenly parentage to interact with. I admit it, we might be a little disappointed if, you know, the definition of a female God came down from the general authorities, because then Heavenly Mother would become just another concept to be put into a handbook. It would become a part of our belief too quickly. You know, it would become codified too early. I think it would actually turn out to be more rich if it had the chance of rising from our collective enchantment. So, in other words, instead of looking for the truth, we put ourselves under periods of enchantment to see the various ways the idea of a goddess could affect us. Now, integrating female deity into our discourse and balancing out patriarchy and matriarchy sounds good as, you know, poetry, but what about as a social technology? Could it be as effective as patriarchy in gathering power? Well, we'd certainly have to spend a lot of time figuring out a lot of structural and administrative issues, and there would be plenty of people who would feel their identities being destabilized by all this. What would serve as a motivation for everyone? We really would have to dive deep into this change of technologies so that we could, in fact, develop one that is more powerful than the one we're leaving behind. Mormonism does have the theological resources to make it happen, but it will definitely have to start with plenty of enchantment. Perhaps this leads us to the possibilities around freedom of religion. Because, you know, it's easy to fight for freedom of religion for your own religion, but it's harder to feel motivated to fight for the freedom of other people's religions. I mean, after all, if those other religions actually get some traction, they might become competitors, which means that your religion could lose power. At least, that's the unenchanted way of looking at it. Mason reminds us that Brigham Young actually proposed a very different approach to other religions and philosophies. He said, quote, "It is our duty and our calling to gather up every item of truth. Yes to the sciences of the day. Yes to the philosophy in every nation, kindred, tongue, and people. No matter how many errors they have a great many truths." Unquote. The implication of that idea is that our job isn't to have, you know, truth fed to us through a heavenly IV. Instead, our job is to actively construct truth. But in order to construct it, we need these other philosophies, cultures, and religions to be healthy. They, in their uniqueness, in fact, in their non-Mormon-ness, are an essential part of the restoration. Their freedom to develop and express their worldviews, especially if it's different from ours, is essential to our success. We need to be enchanted by them in order to fulfill our mission. The interesting thing about, in fact, valuing others' religions is that it enhances the validity of our own religion. We can understand it as being as important as the others in helping to construct multiple models that will give us, as a race, more understanding. It's essential that we develop our own unique worldview so that it can be a robust contributor to the great gathering of truth. This brings us to refugees and immigrants. In order to know about these alternate worldviews and models of reality, in order to enter into the deep conversation we need to have with them, well, we need to have people around who practice and develop these worldviews. So giving immigrants and refugees a stable, nurturing environment is also essential to our mission. I see the same idea being relevant to what Mason calls social justice. Just so you understand what he means by that term, he essentially equates it with the fourth mission of the church, to care for the poor and needy. If we think of the world as a big brain, then caring for the poor and the needy makes it so that the whole brain is working on all cylinders instead of parts of it expending energy on mere survival. The more functional the brain is as a whole, the more resources we have to work with. The main thing I want to point out with all of this is that in all of these cases, we're not doing it because it's the right thing to do, even though it is the right thing to do. We're doing this because we are developing a new and more effective social technology by expanding the sources we can be enchanted by. So instead of being defenders of the fortress, we become the scientists who go out to make connections with the rest of the world, to appreciate various tools, ideas, and worldviews, and experiment with all the ways these tools could work together to make new things. It's not that we're going out to steal ideas for our own profit, but that we expand ourselves and our potential by making true connections with the people and the worldviews around us. Mormons thus become a synthetic people. Synthetic not meaning fake, but meaning having the ability to bring various ideas together into something new, to synthesize something new. We're the connectors. And this approach also takes care of Mason's concern about cultural colonialism. It's true. The LDS Church exports its American-type culture to other nations. And we know that this culture does particular things. It makes particular kinds of people who engage in particular kinds of behavior. That's just what a culture does. But in the end, the Mormon worldview doesn't envision a separated world where identities are ultimately individual. Instead, it envisions a sealed world. Not a world where everyone thinks alike or believes alike, but one where there is a lively, mutual, productive connection between everyone. And the end result isn't like this great culture-less conglomeration, but a collection of cultures in constant development and communication. Maybe what Mason is saying is something like, now that we have the resources and the leisure and the power to no longer be a fortress, let's see if we can develop social technologies that outperform the social technologies we've built ourselves up with. Social technologies that have far less human cost than the previous technologies we've used. It's kind of like he's inviting us to move from a typewriter to a computer that's connected to the internet. So yes, the typewriter can still produce a lot, but a computer with access to the internet can produce quantum levels more. But it takes a new way of thinking, right? A new way of communicating in order to develop and use it. So, you know, maybe we're at the early research phase of this new social technology. And it's kind of like when computers were run on punch cards. It's, you know, more of an experiment than a solution. And a really expensive experiment at that. A lot of people probably didn't see what all the fuss was about and wondered if those researchers were just throwing money down a digital drain. Even though, of course, punch cards are analog. But look where we are now, with our ability to produce, process, and communicate information. A typewriter could never dream of this. I don't know, maybe that's where Mason is trying to point us. Not to a place where we dump our old social technologies and watch our power dwindle away, but one where we develop a new, significantly more productive social technology with far less human cost that's far beyond the imagination of the older technologies. The same way a computer connected to the internet is far beyond the imagination of a typewriter. But in order to do that, we need to learn to re-enchant ourselves. Instead of seeing ourselves as the source of truth, we come to understand that the only way forward is to be seekers of truth. Our strength isn't that we have all the cool stuff. It's that we have access to all the cool stuff that's being developed by other people because we have a real connection with them. And we're practiced at becoming enchanted by their worldview. And they have access to our cool stuff, because they can do the same thing. And the products of all this synthesis that grows between us far outstrips anything we could have made inside our little fortresses. Well, that's my response to Patrick Mason's book, Restoration: God's Call to the 21st Century World. It was an interesting book, and a short one. If you go to faithmatters.org to get the book, they'll send you right over to Amazon. Give it a whirl and see what you think. Meanwhile, keep your eyes open, because Sunstone's Summer Symposium will be happening the last weekend of July, meaning July 28th through 31st. Head over to sunstone.org to get some more information on that. I actually went through the paper proposals a few weeks ago and saw a lot of really interesting stuff. We're definitely going to be having a lot of fun. And if you want to support Sunstone as we get this symposium ready, visit sunstone.org/donate to give us a little monetary love. It's a love language that really picks us up. Well, thanks again for joining me for this week's episode of the Sunstone Podcast. I'll see you again soon.